Rolling Stone magazine recently put out its revised 500 Greatest Albums of All Time list. Yesterday, Ben Marins talked about the offerings pre-1980 on At Issue. And this hour, I get to talk about the music of my generation, Generation X, as we talk about what's on the list post-1980. I'm Veronica Rickert, keeping company with you today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And our guest this hour is Christian Horde. He's a senior editor at Rolling Stone magazine. And we'd love to hear from you this hour. What is on the top of your post-1980 greatest albums of all time list? And to put a finer point on it, we'll be asking the question, does boomer rock still get the lion's share of the props when we're taking stock of the greatest albums in lists like these? And we'd just love to hear what you think. What's on your list at 1-800-642-1234? That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send your email to talk@WPR.org. And you can also chime in on our Facebook page at The Veronica Rickert Show. And Christian Horde, welcome.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, it was a blast reading through this list, the top 500 albums of all time. Of course, I was looking post-1980. You were on yesterday with Ben Marins on an issue talking about the pre-1980 offerings. But it was great to dive back into these again, getting flashbacks of the memories that are attached to these songs. And it made me wonder, why do you think we get so attached to the music we listen to when we're young?
That's a good question. I think that it's probably because we're most open to it. I think that kind of when you're young, you haven't gotten so weighed down by a grind or into a routine. I think your mind is kind of more on, more being entertained, having fun, discovering the world. I think there's just an openness that comes with youth. And so stuff that I loved when I was 20 years old, I'm probably going to love for the rest of my life.
And then if you have kids, you'll drive your kids crazy with your dated music, I guess, for the rest of your life.
No, I have perfect taste, and they will thank me.
Well, you are the editor of Rolling Stone, so that's going to say something. So everyone's got their own criteria. We have our own attachments to music that maybe we grew up with. But as an editor at Rolling Stone, the senior editor, what do you think makes a great album?
I think that a great album has to be really memorable in some way, and it has to kind of have a vision behind it. You can make a great album without kind of reinventing the wheel, but, it's the one sort of at the top of our list. A lot of the classic rock albums, I think of Smile, for instance, they really tended to blaze a trail in some way. So it's about having fresh ideas, and it's about, sort of writing also great tunes that are going to kind of really hit people in the heart.
Well, at the very top of your list, again, it's 500 albums long. At the very top is one probably most people could guess. It's Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Now, that's an earlier album. That's, from, I guess, the 60s, that one. But in terms of albums that show up post-80s, what's high on the list?
That's a good question. I think the sort of highest one that may or may not fit that criteria is London Calling, which came out, I think, end of 79, 1980. The top of the list is kind of boomer rock dominated. It has to do with kind of the way we structured it and the people who voted in the poll. But, Nevermind, I know, is really high up there. Let me think. Thriller is high on there. A couple of U2 albums, I think. The more recent stuff tends to be a little further down the list, though.
Well, let's talk about Nirvana. We have a soft spot for Nirvana here in Madison because it recorded in Smart Studios in Wisconsin.
All right.
Tell us about that album that made the list.
So, Nevermind came out in the fall of 1991 and really, really kind of reshaped the musical landscape. It wasn't the first album to have, loud and ragged guitars and screaming vocals, but it was the first kind of grunge album that really, really took off. And it was, an overnight success and really kicked off, the alt-rock boom that kind of, dominated rock radio and the music business for several years there in the 1990s.
So that was an album that was pretty much a game changer.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's listen to a little bit. We have some Come As You Are. Little bit of Nirvana there from their album Nevermind. And does that album still sound fresh to you? How does it sound when you listen now?
Yeah, it still sounds great. I mean, you know, last year was the 20th anniversary of it. You know, there was a big reissue campaign, so I ended up listening to it again. It sounds really, really great to me still. It's funny, you know, Kurt Cobain sort of disavowed the sound of it. He thought he compared it to a Motley Crue album. it does sound almost a little overproduced to me these days, but, you know, those are really great songs. And a lot of times, you know, these moments in rock and roll attract a certain mythology that's not really true. But this really was a watershed moment in rock, in that every kind of noisy guitar band had a shot of getting signed by major labels after Nevermind hit. And it knocked Michael Jackson off the pop charts at number one, which is really kind of an awesome metaphor for what happened with music in the 90s.
It's interesting that he said that it sounded like a Motley Crue album that was overproduced, because this is grunge. This is supposed to be down and dirty, right?
Right. Well, you know, Kurt was always kind of like dissing anything that sort of seemed shiny and corporate to him. I think he just meant sort of in the way that the sound was kind of extremely clear and everything was really, really kind of big sounding. But, you know, the actual kind of noises that they were making, yeah, were really kind of abrasive.
Now, we haven't talked about yet how this list came to be. Can you give us some of the backstory of this 500 Greatest Albums list?
Sure. This is something we first did in 2003. And the way we made the list was to poll a lot of different voters, people in the music industry, artists themselves. You know, it's like everyone from, you know, MIA to Butch Vig, you know, Clive Davis, you know, certain indie rockers, a couple guys from Metallica, you know, really Britney Spears, I think, even voted. So it was kind of a pretty diverse group of people who I think we asked to name their top 25 albums of all time. And so that's how we put it together. And we've updated it a few times, kind of by taking another poll, but also by kind of just arguing amongst ourselves in the office. So this is the third version of it we've done. And it's available now as a bookazine.
So what are those conversations in the office like? Do they get heated?
Yeah, somewhat, definitely. You know, we tried to really just respect the vote, but we also wanted to make room for newer albums that had come out since we did the vote. So this time around, we added, I think, 30 albums to the list and reshuffled the order a little bit. But, you know, my thought on those arguments is that, you know, that's exactly kind of what this list is supposed to provoke. People get really mad about it, but even that just makes me smile because, you know, that's the whole point. You know, it's supposed to be starting arguments rather than ending them.
Well, speaking of people getting mad about it, and I'm sure you've seen this, but Jim Fazzilli at the Wall Street Journal says that Rolling Stone is biased toward boomer music and that the list kind of perpetuates this idea that rock peaked in the 60s and 70s, and after that it was all downhill. What would you say to that?
I mean, can't entirely disagree with that. You know, this is a magazine that was kind of founded in the 60s in the Summer of Love, and that's, you know, we've covered that music you know, again and again, and those artists have continued to stay active and we keep covering them. And I think, you know, I think that that's what our audience wants to some degree. And I think those people still do deserve it. You know, the highest number of albums by decade on the list, though, is the 1970s. There are 187 of the 500 that came from the 70s, only 105 from the 60s. You know, the 80s had 82, the 90s had something like 75. So it's you know, a lot of boomer rock at the top. Part of it's about the way we did the poll. When you have a vote, certain artists who have a number of good albums, like the Beatles, are really going to have, a bunch of things kind of placed toward the top.
Yeah, they've got three in the top 10.
Yeah.
What do you think about the idea that boomer rock maybe gets too much of the credit in culture? I mean, do you worry, as someone who loves music passionately, that we're cutting off new music at the knees?
I think it does get overcovered. I would actually agree with that. But, you know, I think that every generation kind of discovers its own sounds. I personally, you know, I think every year is a great year for music. You know, every year a lot of people say, oh, it's a terrible year for music. I always disagree with that. And so I think it's important to realize that, you know, all of the best ideas in rock are not taken. They didn't all happen in the 1960s. At the same time, like, I can't really argue with a lot of the choices on this list. I mean, I'm a huge Beatles fan. I'm a huge Stones fan. They were massively important. And there was something really different about the way the industry worked back then in that, you know, it was possible to kind of reach godlike status. And it's everything's kind of more diverse and diffuse now. So, you know, there is something to be said for continuing to talk about those kind of older artists. But, you know, you got to cover the new stuff, too. And we do.
Well, speaking of the newer stuff, we lost Michael Jackson not that long ago, and by that time he'd been reduced to a caricature of himself in a way so that you could kind of forget what an amazing musician that he was, that he had been. But it's hard to beat. You know, you've got Thriller on your list. It's hard to beat that.
Yeah, he was just so cool right about then. He had everything going on. He was just the kind of perfect combination of, you know, sort of dancing skills, coolness, like ridiculously well-tuned pop songwriting and singing gifts. And he was just really, really kind of functioning on a higher plane right when he made that album.
Now is the time.
Do you think, Christian, that having Michael Jackson die in recent years was good for his music? It seems to me like there's been a bit of a Michael Jackson revival.
Yeah, certainly his catalog really took off in terms of sales after he died, and that happens to a lot of people. I was always hoping that he still had something left and still had something more to say. And if you watch, you know, the footage of him rehearsing for the tour that never happened, like, his skills were really quite intact, and they were really singular skills. And that's why it's especially sad that he died, because he was about to take them on the road. But I think dying young is always good for anyone's legend.
Unfortunately, right?
Unfortunately.
So you mentioned that there were 30 new albums, I think, on the list. Of those 30, what sticks out for you?
Let's see. I think that we added a couple Kanye West records. I know he's a kind of polarizing figure, but I do think that he's really special, and that a couple albums that he made in the last decade are going to stick around, you know, 30 years from now. I think it's possible people will talk about them like they talk about, an album like Thriller. It's just, I think his stuff is going to stick, and I think he really was hugely influential. Same with Radiohead. I think that a couple of the albums we added, like In Rainbows, maybe won't be remembered by themselves in the way that a Stones or Beatles record is remembered, but, you know, they're one of those kind of canonical artists, too, who are going to be really sticking in people's minds 30, 40 years down the road.
Well, you mentioned Kanye West, and we've got the track Gold Digger that we can listen to, but tell us about that track first.
Gold Digger was on his second album, Late Registration, my personal favorite of the kind of trio, the College Dropout trio that he made. It was a big hit. It had Jamie Foxx doing his best Ray Charles impression. That was a pop song that was a big hit that kind of sounded like nothing else on the radio, too.
Met her at a beauty salon with a baby Louis Vuitton under her underarm. She said, I could tell you rock, I could tell by your charm. Fars, girls, you got a flock, I could tell by your charm and your arm. But I'm looking for the one. Have you seen her? My psychic told me she have an ex like Serena, Trina, Gina for Lopez. 4 kids, and I gotta take all they bad to showbiz. Okay, get your kids, but then they got their friends. I pulled up in the Benz, they all got a bin. We all went to den, and then I had to pay. If you f***ing with this girl, then you better be paid. You know why? Take too much to touch
her. Listening to the track Gold Digger by Kanye West, one of the newer songs for newer albums, Late Registration, to show up on Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Albums of All Time list. And hip-hop has been sort of the big music story of the last, 20 years maybe now, more?
Yeah, definitely.
Is it still going to be big in the future if you're looking into your crystal ball?
Oh, man, I really have no idea. There were a few years ago, end of the 2000s, where people were really predicting the death of hip-hop, but that hasn't happened. I don't know. I think that it's so in people's blood in the way that kind of early rock and roll was that it's just going to continue in some form. I think just so many young people, the people who are going to be making music in the future, think in terms of hip-hop. It's in the blood. It's in their brain. So, I would think it would continue to be big in some form, sure.
Do you see any other big music stories breaking that are outside that area?
Yeah, I mean, EDM, electronic dance music, is probably the biggest music in the country right now. It doesn't tend to get the mainstream coverage. It doesn't produce a lot of pop hits or stars, you know, sort of outside of people like Skrillex. But, you know, if you look at, you know, dance festivals, the numbers are massive. So I don't know if that music is sort of artistically fruitful in the same way that rock or hip-hop was, but it's pretty massive and has been so in the last few years.
Well, we're talking this hour with Christian Hurd, senior editor at Rolling Stone, about Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Albums of All Time list. That list has been recently revised, and this hour we're looking at what's on the list post-1980. Yesterday they talked about the pre-stuff with Ben Marins on At Issue. But we're wondering about that, and also about, you know, if there's any sort of leaning toward boomer music. Does boomer music still get the lion's share of the musical props as we look back at history and put together lists like this? Wanting to know what's on your favorite list of all times, best albums of all times, and maybe what albums you just imprinted on when you were young that will always be your favorite album forever and ever. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or send your email to talk@wpr.org. And you can also vote on Facebook at The Veronica Rickard Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we talk Rolling Stone and its 500 Greatest Albums of All Time list, which was recently revised. And one of the songs on the list, post-1980, which is what we're talking about today, is this one.
Don't let yourself go. Everybody cries. Everybody hurts sometimes.
It's REM, Telling It Like It Is. Everybody Hurts on the album Automatic for the People, as we talk with Christian Hurd, senior editor of Rolling Stone magazine. That song really had legs. I think it must have been used in about 20 different movies about angst. Great song, though.
Yeah, exactly. But you're absolutely right. I think it is probably the track that is way more famous than any other REM track, which is a little weird because it sounds, you know, not that much like anything else in their catalog.
Well, let's go to our callers now. We've got Dick joining us from Bark River, Michigan. Hi there.
Yep. My question was, I've been listening on the phone for 20 minutes. How closely do your people who vote how do the ratings stand up against the Billboard books, which I don't have handy, of the greatest? And I switched. Rock and roll does not really rock much. I went to world music. I went to my 10 best would include absolutely Madre Deus, which nobody knows here. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Dick. Christian?
I don't really know. I don't really remember offhand what's in the Billboard books. I think that you know, I wish there actually was a little more world music on this list. I think, you know, sort of trying to get the definitive panel together of people ended up making the list not quite as diverse as we would have hoped, just almost on a technical level. So, yeah, it tended to be kind of more rock-centric than I think I personally would have liked. But at the same time, it's actually a pretty darn diverse list.
All right. Thanks for the call. And next to Joe in La Crosse. Hey, Joe.
Hey, thanks so much, Christian, for coming on the show. It's very interesting. I played music in Madison back in the late 80s and early 90s. And I was kind of curious because, you know, it's the era I grew up in, so I'm biased in its favor about sort of pre-Nirvana, alt-rock, Replacements, Husker Du, REM. One of my favorite albums, and certainly in my top 10 probably, is Camper Van Beethoven's Our Beloved Revolutionary Sweetheart. I still listen to it often, and I just can't get enough of it. I think it was sincere but fun, and just for alt-rock at the time, it had an element of fun to it that was lacking. As did many of their albums. And I was kind of curious of that sort of genre, how they managed, given it sounds like it was a pop artist who contributed highly to your list.
Okay, good question. Thanks, Joe. And Christian?
Yep. I'm not quite sure if I got the question. certainly 80s indie rock is something I love very, very much. Replacements are one of my all-time favorite bands. I do like Kemper Van Beethoven. I think that the album he mentioned is actually a great album. It doesn't quite, I think, have the reputation that it would have needed to get, you know, enough votes to end up on the list. And, you know, I heard something about pop artists. You know, we did have a few in the voters, certainly. Britney Spears voted. It tended to be kind of more classic rock dudes and established industry figures, too. I'm not sure if that answers the question.
Okay, well, thank you, Joe. Hope that answers your question. And we move next to Dave in Wanakee. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, I found that Rolling Stones' taste in music is very popular, very produced, and very promoted. And my growth musically, or my range musically, really changed when I stopped paying attention to it and started going on the internet and looking at what's out there, especially in the instro surf punk category, I guess. I note that a band like Man or Astro Man, who put out, you know, half dozen albums and were very popular and toured all over, they couldn't get a mention. Or Southern Culture on the Skids, or Los Straitjackets, or all these bands that they do very well across the country, and they definitely have excellent albums, but they don't get noticed in Rolling Stone.
All right, thanks. Thanks for the comment, Dave. A couple of questions or comments packed into there, Christian, including, you know, how does Rolling Stone pick its coverage, but, you know, also getting at bands that don't make it, and some of Dave's own interests. What do you think?
Yeah, I got to kind of disagree with that a bit. I think that we tend to give, you know, the giant slots in the magazine to bigger names, and it does lean toward classic rock a lot, but we really cover a lot of indie rock. You know, I edit the review section now. If you kind of scroll through all the album reviews on our website, I think you might be surprised. We review a lot of records and a lot of stuff you've probably never heard of. You know, I'm just thinking the issue we're working on right now, it has reviews of, I think, a band like Jeff the Brotherhood, who are kind of an upcoming noisy rock band from Nashville, certainly an indie rock act, even though they're on a major label. You know, The Very Best, this kind of strange electro afro pop act. You know, so I think that people kind of look at the cover, maybe look at who gets the big illustration in the review section, and make judgments about what we do. And we cover a lot of stuff, and it's really important to me personally that you know, we focus not on just the big names, but on people who are smaller names, but doing really good and interesting work.
All right. Well, thank you for that call, Dave. And I want to listen a little bit more. You know, one of the albums on here is Post by, oops, sorry, wrong. Purple Rain is what I want to play. Purple Rain by Prince. And the song When Doves Cry is one we've got to listen to here. And I still love the song. And this is from, you know, probably my formative years. I can hear it now, and I think, okay, maybe I can hear that it sounds a little cheesier now, because you don't hear songs that sound like this anymore, but I still think it sounds fantastic. What do you think about Purple Rain?
I love that era of Prince in general, and actually, maybe Purple Rain is sort of this big, like, kind of right-in-the-pocket ballad for him, but I do think a lot of music today kind of sounds like that era of Prince, like, you know, sort of young people, quote-unquote hipsters, are really kind of relying on synthy kind of 80s sounds that people like Prince did a lot of great things with. But yeah, I love Purple Rain, absolutely.
The sweat of your body covers me. Can you, my darling, can you picture this? Dream of a Concordia, an ocean of violets in bloom.
When Doves Cry from Prince's album Purple Rain. I guess he still goes by the artist now, Christian? Or is he back to Prince?
I think he's back to Prince, right?
Is he back to Prince?
Yeah,
okay.
he started using real letters rather than just abstract symbols. Yes.
Must make it easier for you guys.
Yeah, it does, and easier to talk about.
In terms of new stuff that is on your list, Vampire Weekend, let's talk about them.
Yeah. So they're a pretty new guitar band. Their debut, self-titled, came out, I think, in 08, early 08. And, you know, they're a kind of a buzz band that kind of cut across generations. I think that if you're like sort of a Venn diagram between Pitchfork and Rolling Stone, they're kind of in the sweet spot. But, you know, they were kind of very influenced by Afropop, by what Paul Simon did with Afropop. But I think that, you know, the frontman, Ezra Koenig, is just a really, really sharp writer, and that's kind of the key to their success.
Well, we've got a track here, M79. Can you tell us about that?
I don't remember off the top of my head. I'm pretty sure that's on the debut. I can't remember specifics about it. Almost all of their songs tend to be very, very tuneful. You know, Ezra Koenig is a wonderful melody writer. I would not be surprised if that's the case with this song.
Well, let's let it speak for itself. Here's M79.
It's gonna take a little time while you're waiting like a factory line. I'll ride across the park, backseat on the 79. Wasted days you come to pass. So go, I know you would not stay.
Song M79, debuting on Rolling Stone's list of the 500 greatest albums of all time list. And we want to point out, too, that their list of the 100 greatest guitarists is also out today, so you can check that out as well. As we talk with Christian Horde, senior editor at Rolling Stone, about the new and revised list. And we'll go next to DJ, joining us from Stevens Point. Hi, DJ. Let's try again. There, DJ, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, go ahead.
I was going to say that it's CJ here, and I'm a DJ. I have to listen to a lot of music I don't like, but I love Rolling Stone, and I thank you very much for running this program, and to NPR Music and everybody from Wisconsin Public Radio and The Current and Minneapolis for bringing so many new artists to the air for us to hear. But my most influential album, or the most influential album of my lifetime for me, has been Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness by the Smashing Pumpkins. I think it defines that era and transform music.
Okay, well, and CJ, thank you so much for calling, and thank you for all the thank yous and for listening. I'm glad you're getting a lot out of the music here. And Christian, what about Smashing Pumpkins?
Smashing Pumpkins may have gotten shortchanged on this list, I will admit. I think they only had one entry, and it was not Melancholy, which is probably their best and most famous album. It was, I believe, Siamese Dream. So, yeah, a very kind of important alt-rock album. Maybe you should have made the list. I can't tell you how close it came, but, yeah. And thanks also.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling, CJ. You know, think about lists like this, Christian, is it just invites arguing. People are so
right.
Personalized in their attachment to music and what they consider great music. I mean, putting together a list like this must in some ways just be an exercise in frustration for you because everybody's going to disagree.
You know, thankfully, the vote sort of takes a bit of that kind of angst away from the process for us. You know, we do our best to assemble a diverse and hopefully smart group of voters, and then we really kind of let it run. You know, we have like Ernst & Young crunch the numbers, and so we don't have to agonize so much about, you know, whether, you know, Graceland should be number 42 or 47 or stuff like that. You know, and I try not to sort of get too personally wrapped up in it. It is what it is. I think it's a really great list. If you just pick any random album off of it, you really can't go wrong. You know, it's obviously not my personal taste entirely, but like I said, it's supposed to start arguments and really rather than end them.
Do you ever hear back from the artists who are up in arms about where they are on the list?
We've heard from artists on other lists. I don't know about this one so much. We got a few sort of pieces of interesting feedback on our guitarist list, which, as you said, is out today. I don't know about 500 albums. I'm sure we made someone angry, but probably made some people happy too, I hope.
That's a long list. I mean, this must have taken a while to compile.
Right. Yeah. So, like I said, it was first done by a vote in 2003. You know, I think we sent out very fancy ballots to a great many people, and I think most people voted. You know, I think that was kind of the more difficult process for us, is just, you know, kind of getting a diverse enough group of people to vote, because, you know, we were putting this list in their hands, really. And you know, considering all the ways in which it could have gone, it came out pretty well.
Great. Well, let's go back to the phones. Here we've got Chris joining us from Hurley. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Thanks for the program, guys. I was just wondering, first off, you were asking about influential albums that you always listen to. One of those for me is the Metallica Black album, and I was wondering how that fared on the list. And then I was also wondering if any country acts got on the list, like, you know, mega stars like Kenny Chesney or Garth Brooks or any of those, or if Rolling Stone kind of just swept those guys away.
All right. Thanks, Chris. Christian?
Metallica is on the list. The Black Album is number 255. Master of Puppets also made it. Master of Puppets did better, actually, at number 167. I actually found that a little personally surprising because Black Album has kind of the bigger reputation. The other question was about country. There is quite a bit of country on the list, but it tends to be the classic guys, you know, Johnny Cash and Patsy Cline, kind of people like that. I personally think that kind of newer country gets sort of a bad rap in Rolling Stone even. I think people like Brad Paisley are kind of genius, but kind of none of those guys, I think, quite had the reputation that you need to get on a list like this.
I want to read an email here. This is from Scott, who says, this 40-something thinks that the 70s were the least interesting musical decade. Bowie, yes. Carole King, yes. Big Star, yes. And don't forget about Wilco, Flaming Lips, and Neutral Milk Hotel.
Well, what about punk? You know, punk was the 70s. I mean, that was tremendously interesting explosion of new music. The other guys he mentioned, I think, actually did pretty well on our list. Wilco is on there. Oh, I will confess that Neutral Milk Hotel was the subject of much debate around the office.
Oh yeah.
You know, no one kind of likes that album. You either don't like it or really, really love it. There were a couple passionate fans here. I think it ultimately did not make the list. I didn't look at all the emails we've gotten about this. I'm sure we offended some people. Sorry.
It's your job, right? You're supposed to offend people.
Kind of, yeah.
All right, Jim, next in Fort Atkinson. Hello, Jim.
Hi, Veronica. I'd like to vote for Pat Metheny Group, As Falls Wichita, So Falls Wichita Falls. And this was 84, 85 when an office worker introduced me to this kind of music. He didn't listen to the radio at all. And smooth jazz was introduced a couple years later all over the radio. It's hard to find now. I also like Western swing, and I'm sure those two genres are not recognized in this poll.
And Christian, are they?
Pat Metheny is not on the list. He's a little outside of the rock and roll spectrum. He's not a pop artist. I would imagine we haven't really covered him over the years. Western swing, I think, you know, Willie Nelson made a couple Western swing albums. I know he's on our list a bunch of times. Off the top of my head, I can't remember if there are any others. I'm going to guess not.
All right, well, thank you so much for your call. And as we go into our next break, Bjork made the list with her album Post. And she's someone who can be an acquired taste, but tell us about what you know about Bjork and how she fared on this list.
Bjork had one album. It was Post, which I think you could say is probably her biggest album. You know, she was an absolute original, you know, sort of Icelandic vocalist who's very strange and writes strange lyrics and like these kind of like fragmented electronic arrangements. And of course, you know, like her voice is really like no other. I know when I was writing a lot, I kept kind of using Bjorkian as like an adjective or Bjorky because, you know, she was the original. It was so distinct that it was kind of like, you know, she was a standard that people sort of aspired to in terms of just singing weirdly. But yeah, she's definitely an original.
All right, here is Army of Me.
You're all right. There's nothing wrong. Self-sufficiency, please. And get to work. And if you complain, why?
Listening to Bjork there from her album Post as we talk with Christian Hord, senior editor at Rolling Stone, about Rolling Stone's new revised 500 Greatest Albums of All Time list. And wondering what is on your list post-1980. It's a massive list, 500 albums. So we've split it up. Yesterday, Ben Marins did before the albums before 1980. Today, we're doing 1980 and later.
to see what happened in music then. And we're also wondering what you think about the greatest albums of all time, post-1980. What's on your list? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. I'm Veronica Bickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Song Forgive Them Father from the album The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. It shows up at number 314 on Rolling Stone's revised 500 Greatest Albums of All Time list as we talk with Christian Hord, the senior editor at Rolling Stone. And Christian, this was a huge album for Lauryn Hill, and it was, I think it was her first one post-Fugees, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. It was a huge, huge album that she really never followed up, sadly. But, you know, it was... It really kind of found a sweet spot there between hip-hop and R&B. She really kind of took 70s soul and just made it kind of, you know, signify to the hip-hop generation. Yeah, really great record. And she kind of, yeah, didn't quite fulfill the promise of that record.
So what is she up to now? I know that she had done some unplugged stuff.
Yeah, she still tours every now and then. I think she was having some kind of money troubles lately. I think she's been maybe making headlines for reasons that are not what you'd hope. I don't know, though. You know, D'Angelo, who is kind of a similar story, seems to be getting it together now. So maybe Lauryn Hill can finally make a great follow-up.
Yeah, it was a fantastic album. That's one that I listened to over and over, and it still sounds great listening to it there. Dylan is joining us next from Knife River, Minnesota. Hi, Dylan.
Hey, how's it going?
Going well. How are you?
I'm doing good. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to chime in. A few of my personal favorites from the hip-hop genre would be definitely Snoop Dogg's Doggy Style, The Chronic by Dr. Dre, and... thirdly, a very underrated album. I'm not sure where it would be on the list, but it would be Illmatic by Nas, which, like, I mean, it's just poetry. It's just, you got to listen to the lyrics, and it's just incredible. And so those are some of my favorites.
Are those things that you still listen to now?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, it's funny. It's like... you know, years and years and years have gone by, but I listen to them, and, hey, they're still awesome.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Dylan. What about Snoop Dogg?
Snoop Dogg, I don't think made the list. The other two albums he mentioned are definitely on there. Nas's Illmatic, I think it's around number 400. And, yeah, great, great record. He was a tremendously skilled lyricist. You know, he still is. And then, you know, of course, The Chronic by Dr. Dre was a really big and influential album. It was one of those kind of big, as I remember, because I was in middle school then, it kind of a big crossover hip-hop record, you know. Kind of like frat guys and, you know, white suburban kids really, really picked up on that audience. And, you know, we just talked about Lauryn Hill taking 70s music and making it for the hip-hop generation. That's kind of what Dr. Dre did, too. He took all this kind of classic funk music from P-Funk, George Clinton, really used it to make these kind of very distinct hip-hop beats. So, yeah, big album, still influential.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Dylan, for the call. And we go next to Kevin, joining us from Wauwatosa. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, I'm calling to see, you know, how does this poll work as far as creativity and the depths of the artists? I think the previous caller just mentioned something about, you know, the lyrics. It was pure poetry. I was thinking of creative people such as Joni Mitchell. You got Steely Dan in there. You know, how do you justify, you know, who you ask to vote or and take this poll versus, you know, what's creative versus what's popular?
It's an interesting question, Kevin. Thanks. And Christian?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what we did was get a diverse list of people. It was a little classic rock leaning, I think, because that's generally how we operate. But like I said, there were a lot of young people who voted on there. I mean, I got to vote too, which was cool. And I think what we asked people to do is to name their top 25 or 50 albums in order of importance, which is sort of different from saying best. I think most people ignored that instruction and just named their favorite albums. I think it's hard to have a set criteria for what makes a great album. You know, I think, yeah, Joni Mitchell wrote some lyrics that were like poetry, but, you know, there are punk records that really maybe are not so poetic but still great. It's kind of hard to put a fine point on what makes a great album. I mean, for me, it's something that just sticks around. But, yeah, we didn't try and circumscribe, you know, the criteria for people too much. We just let them vote.
Now, you mentioned that Britney Spears voted, and she was one of the artists who voted. Who else? Can you give us any names?
Actually, I have the list here. Maybe I shouldn't be so proud of Britney voting, but she was my go-to example of a young person. We had a lot of critics vote, actually, and I come from that background, so I was glad. You know, we had Billy Joe Armstrong from Green Day, Mary J. Blige voted. And a couple other Green Day guys. You know, we had, like, Jerry Goffin of, you know, the famous Goffin King songwriting duo. We actually had Ezra Koenig, who we talked about earlier, mm-hmm. Vampire Weekend. Moby voted, you know, and we had, like I said, a lot of writers and critics, hopefully kind of well-established ones, like David Frick, who's one of our great longtime writers. Yeah, and, you know, we had people like Barry Weiss, who I think at the time was the CEO of Universal Republic Records. So, yeah, probably, I think, I'm looking at it here, maybe 75 names.
So this was not anonymous, right?
We published the list of voters because we wanted to be clear about that, but I don't think we released, you know, individual ballots.
So you have the lists of all of these amazing artists that their top 25. I mean, that's amazing. You've got these personalized lists of what they think is the best.
Yeah, I think actually we might have put a few online, the few that were, like, really, really cool. You know, we actually published the ballot with the handwriting and whatever. I think a couple of them were really entertaining. Not remember them off the top of my head, though.
Well, you mentioned Green Day, and they do show up on your list, at least 225 at that slot. You have American Idiot. Can you tell us about that album?
Right. So that was a modern concept album. You know, it was a real change for Green Day, who had been kind of known as this kind of bratty punk band. Certainly, they were growing out of that, but they weren't really known as kind of a politically active rock band, and that's exactly what they became. You know, it came out in 2004, in the sort of height of the Bush era. You know, it was really a protest album about what was going on in the Bush administration and the war, and it was also an old-fashioned concept album, and it really, really revived and changed their career.
Listening there to Green Day's album American Idiot, that track is called Wake Me Up When December Ends. And we'll go back to our phone lines now. We've got AJ from Rochester, Minnesota. Hi there.
How you doing?
Doing good. How are you?
I'm all right. My favorite album is ELO Out of the Blue. And when I first heard it, I only heard one cut, and I turned around and bought the album, and when I opened up the album, my eyes got big, and then I turned around and listened to the music, and I just fell in love with them.
That's the way it is with albums, when you fall in love. It is like a falling in love process, isn't it, Christian?
Yeah, yeah. Some of the best affairs you can have in your life is falling in love. Sorry, I don't think that album made it, but I'm sure, like, you know, there was a couple ELO songs on our 500 Greatest Songs list, which is a different book we put out.
Christian, is there an album that you're in love with right now, something new?
What have I been listening to? We just ran a big review of the Rick Ross record, which is pretty good. You know, I really like this new record by Frank Ocean, who is an R&B singer. He sort of made headlines when he came out as, I think, bisexual a few weeks ago. But it's not a perfect album, but he is a very kind of arty soul man, and he's doing really interesting things, and I think he's someone who's going to stick around for a while. So I'm pretty excited about him and that record.
So I'm sure you got into the music journalism career because you love music, and music is such an emotional medium, as we're hearing from people who are passionate about the music that they love. Has working in it and working in that field so closely, doing it for your job, has it in any way taken away from the passion, the emotional rush that we get from music?
It's funny, we were just talking about this last night. Sometimes the ears do get a little tired. You know, I consider it my job to really keep up with what's going on musically and what are the good, new, interesting records that I edit the review section, among other things. And, yeah, there are mornings where it's like I'm riding on the train to work and it's like, oh, man, I really need to play this record that we're reviewing so I know what I think about, and it can feel a bit like a burden. I don't know. Like, music is still, it's something that I physically kind of crave, you know, certain moments, and I'll be sitting around and thinking, boy, what's missing? And it's like, you know, you got to put on tunes. One of my favorite things is just to walk around the city and listen to my favorite stuff.
Because it feels like a soundtrack.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a physical craving, really.
What is your favorite music for walking around New York?
Anything, really. I feel like when I've had free time lately, I've been going back to sort of some of the indie rock faves of my, like, college days, like people like Pavement. I'm absolutely in love with the Replacements at that time. I don't know why exactly. Maybe out of nostalgia, I've just been drawn to that lately. But it's really, really anything. It's usually new stuff, though.
Yeah, the soundtrack, the music of soundtrack thing is interesting. And now we've all got our own soundtracks. iPods are so easy to take with us that it makes you wonder if it'll be harder to put lists like this together, I don't know, 50 years down the road, because we have the opportunity to get so niche with our music taste right now.
Yeah, I think that you don't tend to get the same kind of consensus around big records these days that you might have gotten 30, 40 years ago, because there are, you know, more records than ever, for one thing, and also because it's just so easy to hear them, and, you know, people are going to have more favorites. I think overall that's a good thing. It's just that, you know, it means that not everyone is talking about the same record at the same time in the way that they used to.
Well, another phone call here. Brenda is joining us from Galena, Illinois. Hi, Brenda.
Yippee. Hi. Good day. John Prine.
Yeah.
Bruce Doines.
John Prine is on the list with his debut. Self-titled debut. That's a pre-1980 album, but I'm a huge John Prine fan, and he's someone that I've actually only discovered in the last few years, and I think he's really criminally underrated. He is, I think, one of the great American songwriters. He kind of is incisive in the same way Dylan is, but he also has this very, like, kind of warm Midwestern spirit about him. I really love him. I wish we could have gotten another John Prine record on the list, actually.
So I know Angel from Montgomery, but if you were going to recommend another must-listen John Prine track, what would it be?
God, there are so many. You know, kind of his famous song, besides that one you mentioned, is like Sam Stone, which is about a returning Vietnam vet. Maybe that's a little more on the kind of more dinosaur song. One, like, recent song he's done was this duet with Iris DeMent called In Spite of Ourselves. I absolutely recommend that song to anyone. It's this really kind of funny he said, she said duet. Great details. In Spite of Ourselves.
In Spite of Ourselves.
5 or 6 years ago. Great song.
With Iris DeMent. Okay.
Iris DeMent.
We're going to listen. And Tom next, joining us from Menominee. Hi, Tom.
How are you doing?
Doing good. How are you?
Good, good. I just feel like we need to do justice to the hour by mentioning Bruce Springsteen here. Just over the span of time from post-1980, I mean, Darkness on the Edge of Town, The River, Born in the USA, The Rising, and then as recently as Magic, just great albums, with very thematic albums. I'm just wondering your comments on that.
Great. I'm glad you brought up The Boss.
Yes.
Christian?
Springsteen, as you might guess, did very, very well in this poll. He had 8 albums. He's kind of an amazing case. I really find it sort of amazing how much work and passion he still pours into it every night. He's still over in Europe these days playing like 4-hour shows. You know, this is 40 years after his career began. And, he's kind of one of our main guys. If there were like a Mount Rushmore of rock for Rolling Stone, he'd be on it.
Well, and Christian, we've gotten almost all the way through this hour, and no one has yet said the name Madonna. We have to, don't we?
I love Madonna. Absolutely.
She is on your list, and I'm guessing more than once, but we have her here. We have a cut at number 239 from the album Like a Prayer, Cherish. So let's listen to a little bit of that. And Christian, do you remember, did Britney Spears just have a whole bunch of Madonna albums on her list?
I don't actually remember.
No.
But yeah, Madonna's on there 3 times. The highest place she got was, I think, in the 180s with the Immaculate Collection, which is, I think, actually almost a perfect record. It's a singles compilation that came out in, like, the early 90s. It's just really great from start to finish.
And let's get in one more. This is number 305. Lucinda Williams shows up on the list at number 305, her album Car Wheels on a Gravel Road. And we're working on getting that one as we work on that. Tell us about Lucinda.
Yeah, actually, funny you mention it right after Immaculate Collection, because that's another album I think is almost perfect. It's an amazing record. She spent many, many years on it. It's this kind of old country record, sort of perched between more straightforward kind of like folk music, rock music, and also, you know, she's from the South, had certainly a country element, just like really immaculately written, beautiful love songs.
And we'll listen to a little bit.
On a gravel road, car wheels on a gravel road, car wheels.
Car Wheels on a Gravel Road from Lucinda Williams. And Christian Hoard, thank you so much for joining us this hour. It's been fun.
Oh, it was really fun. Thanks so much for having me.
Christian Hoard, our guest this hour, senior editor at Rolling Stone magazine, as we talk about their revised 500 Greatest Albums of All Time list. And don't forget, their 100 Greatest Guitarist list is out today as well. Thanks to Brett Jaspers for producing this hour, and Marika Suval for her production help, and also Brittany DeAnda for running the board and filling in today for Rhonda Fanning. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.